She's feisty, she's funny, and she tells it like it is. Get ready for Empower Readings with Corby Mitlide. What are your opportunities right now? What are the possibilities? Ask Corby and cross the bridge from fear to fearlessness and fly. Here's your host, Corby Mitlide.
Welcome to the world post-election, post-Sandy, post-the whole Michigas. We're not going to be discussing politics tonight. I don't believe that people should gloat. I don't believe that people should piss and moan. If your guy won, yay. If your guy did not win, there's always room at the table. End of political discussion. On the other hand, what comes right after Halloween? The holidays! Some of us got to see red and green and tinsel and Santa Claus cuddling up to the witches and the zombies. And some stores were kind enough to at least wait until November 1st. Of course, back when I was a child, you waited until Thanksgiving. But these days, you know, everything is a rush. So at least the one good thing about holidays is all of those wonderful holiday traditions, especially around food. So who better than to kick off the holiday season type of show than the fabulous Chef Christie, my buddy from Atlanta, who's here to talk to us about traditions and spirituality in food and all those wonderful things that go with the holidays. Yo, Miss Christie, good to see you.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Good. Food is, next to presents, one of the things that we all look forward to in just about every holiday at the end of the year. So how can we recognize the spirituality of it, why we do things? How can we make food more than just a bunch of calories on a pretty dish?
Well, and I want to back up to something you said just a second ago, food next to presents, and in a lot of cases, the food was the present.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an awful lot of exchanging of food items as gifts that go along with all of the holidays, really, around the calendar. And we tie a lot of traditions and memories and good feelings into those gifts, and especially, the autumnal and equinox holidays, solstice holidays, there's a lot of baking and gift making that's traditional, gingerbread houses or donuts for Hanukkah or whatever your particular religion. There's a lot of memory making, family time, tradition observance that goes into the preparation of food that's used as gifts. So I think that's important to recognize too, that it's not an either or. It's not the gifts and or the presents. They're all tied in together.
That's true. And don't forget the traditional cookie swap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tradition that I've seen really picking up, especially in an awful lot of offices that, I won't say all the women, because guys cook too, but everybody brings in about 6 dozen cookies, and everybody leaves with 6 dozen cookies, but they're not necessarily the same cookies. I think that's kind of cool.
It is, and you're right. I've seen that happen a lot more recently than I ever remembered seeing it before, and I don't know what to attribute that to, but I like it. I think that's a great thing to do. It serves the office environment well. It's a tradition that has adapted itself to a more modern setting, which might kind of fit into what we're talking about a little later on. So maybe that's why it's become so popular. It doesn't explain the popularity of cupcake bars. I still haven't quite figured out why there are so many of those popping up, but hey.
Portable calories, that's all.
That's for sure.
So start us off with traditions. I know that there used to be actual fortune-telling games with food, didn't there?
Oh, there still are. Oh, absolutely. And I think you have to start this discussion, I think I really want to mention that a lot of the holidays at this time of year, starting with the harvest festivals and going on through the solstice festivals, are aimed at end of year, bringing in the harvest, abundance, calling the sun back. All of these ancient agricultural festivals are where we really have to start this conversation, because the food is tied into the reverence of the land, of the harvest, of the, you know, calling on whatever god you pray to bring you good weather, to bring you a bountiful harvest, to the point where the Celts would marry the king to the land, and there was this elaborate ceremony where that was part of his kingship, is that he married the land, and the harvest was tied to his kingship. So you really can't underestimate the importance of bringing food into a celebration like that, because it was the reason. You know, feeding yourself, feeding your family, feeding your village was the reason to celebrate. And then as you get on into the later part of the year where the sun has gone away and you've got the darkest days of the year, then you're trying to get the sun to come back, and you're, you know, encouraging sun and light and warmth and family and friends and all that as part of it. But yeah, I think the agricultural ties tie directly to the spiritualism. I mean, it's one and the same when you go farther back into the really, really old observances. And then and that kind of makes sense then when we start talking about why food was used to divine things, why foods were used in divination games, because it's got this direct tie. And the Romans had a goddess of the orchards named Pomona. And Pomona was revered at the harvest time of year, and all of our apple games, the games where you peel an apple and you get as long a peel off of it as you possibly can, and then there are various things that you do. You throw it over your shoulder, and whatever shape it takes on the floor behind you is the initial of the first name of your lover or your husband or whatever. Throwing it into water and see if it turns into a curlicue or if it turns into some other shape. I remember doing this one where we twisted the apple stem, and every time you twisted it, you recited a letter of the alphabet, and then whatever letter the stem broke at was the letter of the first initial of the person you were going to marry.
I remember that.
All of these apple games, bobbing for apples, all of these date all the way back to the Romans and the festivals of Pomona and her harvest festival that was at this time of year. Okay. And then there's all sorts. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What is the bobbing for apples thing about anyway, besides laughing at your friends and ducking them?
Just another contest. And I guess one of the things that you can judge is the first person to get a bite wins. Knows is the first person who's going to marry is the one who's going to win the race, or whatever it is that you say that it's going to stand for. The first person that succeeds at the task is it. So that's kind of the point behind that one. But there are other types of foods that are used in divination, too, like throwing salt, throwing corn in the Southwest. Corn was used in the same kind of way. Tea leaf reading, coffee ground reading in the Caribbean. There's all sorts of things that people do with food to do divination, and those kinds of games are common in harvest festivals and in end of year festivals, because you've got the harvest, you've got all the food in, you don't have the party until the harvest is done. So once you've got all the food in and the food is stored, you've got this abundance. And so whatever you've got an abundance of, you're going to start playing games with. And so that's kind of the tie to that. And so people did all these sorts of things. And around Samhain and all of the holiday festivals around that, we get a lot of divination games, because that's kind of the time of year when the veil between the worlds is supposed to be thinner. And so you get a lot of those kind of games, and that's their tie to spirituality. Another one that a food that has really taken an interesting journey is the king cake. Now, do you have king cakes that show up north in the New York area?
No, but since we had our honeymoon in New Orleans, we know all about king cake.
Okay, so king cake started out as a celebration, as a food associated with Three Kings Day, which is Epiphany, or the St. Melchior, Balthazar, and Caspar Saints Days, or whichever variety of that you celebrate, the three wise men. and they show up on Twelfth Night, on Epiphany, or, yeah, Twelfth Night, and then the next day is Epiphany. That's when the king cake, that's when it started out. It was for them. And the divination game was, there was something baked into the cake. And it started out as a bean, and later on you could it could be a coin. There are versions where multiple things are baked in, such as a coin, a ring, a key, various objects, and then whoever gets whichever object, the one with the ring is going to be the one who get married, the one with the coin is going to be rich. You know, there's some bad things and good things, and they're all different divination games. But then over time, that king cake has moved to Mardi Gras, which is a festival that's a month and a half later. But that's kind of morphed into a different holiday. But that originally started out as one of the Christmas holiday or Epiphany holiday or Orthodox Christian holidays when they celebrate Christmas later on in January. But that's a pretty famous one, and I think that's it's breaking out of the region. I know it was just New Orleans for a long time. It's pretty common here in the grocery stores now. I think the funniest thing is that they don't bake. Now it's a baby, which I guess is supposed to represent the Christ child. It was never supposed to be the baby in the cake, but now it is. And now, because of litigation, they don't put the baby in the cake. They put the baby in a little plastic bag next to the next to the cake.
So you buy the king cake. Everything.
I know. So now you get the baby outside of the cake, and I guess if you want to stick it in, you can just, you know, stuff it into the bread. It's really more of a bread than a cake, but
right.
You can stuff it in some place, but they don't want to be liable for choking hazards, I guess, so they can't bake the baby in the cake anymore.
And have all your guests, you know, sign a disclaimer. Now, aren't there certain colors with a king cake in particular?
Yeah, the colors of Mardi Gras are the colors associated with it now, which weren't associated with it when it was the Three Kings Day cake. But the Mardi Gras colors are the purple, gold, and green. And so those are usually iced on the cake now. But America is such a melting pot. We are such a conglomerate of religions and nationalities. And for all that we think that we are divided into two different, not to go back to your political conversation, but we are so many more pieces of the puzzle than that. And because of that, our traditions kind of get mishmashed. And this king cake that we're talking about is a perfect example of that. It's moved holidays. The baby has moved outside the cake. The colors have changed. You know, all of this has morphed. And part of that, I think, is because we don't know where our traditions come from. And so we tend to, you know, the old saying is those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it badly. And so if you don't learn what the traditions are that you're going with, then you don't know why you're doing certain things. And I think that's really important, especially for your children, that if you're going to have a traditional something in your house, that you know why you're having that traditional something, or why you're not doing that traditional thing. I've heard a lot of people say that they're not celebrating this holiday or that holiday, and I'm always curious as to why, because I'm curious to know what part of that holiday they don't like. I'm especially curious when people say they don't want to celebrate Thanksgiving, because I don't really see Thanksgiving as being a religion specific. And there are a lot of cultures that have Thanksgiving type holidays. But yeah, there are a fair number of people who say, well, we don't celebrate Thanksgiving. Like it's, you know, that's not in our religion to give thanks for abundance. I always think that that's an odd statement, but I think it's more about
the big family gathering. Yeah, Christmas is important, but you can imagine a Christmas with just two people. You can't imagine Thanksgiving without the herd.
Right.
And some people think that the herd is exhausting.
Go ahead. I forget what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Well, when you're talking about traditions, and if you don't know the traditions, why are you still doing them? That
right.
just reminds me of the tale of the meatloaf story. And I know this happened with our family. There was the occasion of you would make a meatloaf and you'd always cut off the end and put it in a little separate dish. And I said, why? And my mother looked at me and said, I don't know. Your grandmother always did it. And I asked my grandmother why, and she looked at me like I was an idiot. And she said, because I always had a pan that was too small. But my mother thought that it was whatever was the Jewish tradition, you know, the little piece for Elijah. We didn't know. But right. She always cut the top off the meatloaf.
Right. Because that was the tradition. And so it seemed like a good tradition to carry on, not knowing that it was because it would have hung out the side of the dish if she hadn't.
Yes.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. And another, well, and we want to talk about holiday, about family traditions. One of my family's traditions was always an orange in the toe of the stocking. And I always loved that. And it was, it just wasn't that you always knew that that was at the bottom. Regardless of what was in the top of it or in the heel, you always knew when you got to the bottom there was a tangerine or an orange or something like that. That really goes back to time when oranges are seasonal to this time of year, to Christmas time. And very often, if you read Dickens, if you go back to reading the Christmas Carol or you read some of the other Dickens, that might be the Christmas present was an orange because it was rare, it was imported, it was in season right then, but to get one into the northern climes where it wasn't native was a big deal.
That's but one of the amazing things that now we are so glutted with how much food we can have. The idea of that is just beyond belief. Now, we have a call specifically for you. That's Pat from Toledo, Ohio. You ready to take one?
Sure.
Okay. Pat from Toledo, Ohio. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
Thanks. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Pat.
How are you doing, dear?
Good.
All right. My question is, in the song, We Wish You a Merry Christmas, they talk about figgy pudding. What is the importance of figgy pudding to the traditions of Christmas, and where would that have come from?
Okay. Have you seen A Christmas Carol?
Yes.
Okay. The scene with the Cratchit family Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at the end, and they've got such a pathetic little tiny bird, and they're making such a big deal about what a wonderful feast they've had, and everything is just pathetically small, right? And at the very end, they bring in this pudding, and they set it on fire, and they put the holly into it, and they make such a big deal, and it's minuscule, and they've got this enormous family, and they go, oh, Mother, it's the most beautiful thing. That's the figgy pudding. Okay?
Okay.
So the tradition of boiling a pudding in a sack or steaming a pudding in a sack goes way back in English history, English food, and that's where it comes from, is English cuisine. And a pudding, in the way they're talking about, is a flour-based, kind of a steamed cake. And it would have different types of fruits in it, including figs. So right. A figgy pudding would specifically be a pudding that was boiled like that, that contained a lot of figs. We have fruitcake today, which is more or less a descendant of that. But the figgy pudding was traditionally done at Christmas. You'd have different types of puddings at different types of year, at different times of year. But the figgy pudding was the one that was made with figs at Christmas time. And if you think about that dinner at the Cratchit family, that's an example of serving the figgy pudding and what a big deal they make out of it. And the irony of the family is that they've got this huge family and this tiny little thing. But that's Dickens writing social commentary about how important that figgy pudding is and what a big deal they made about it, even though it was way too small for all the number of people that she was trying to feed.
So it was more of a, would you consider it more like a status symbol then?
Ooh, yeah, probably. Well, you know, the fact that they pour brandy over it and set it on fire, it's supposed to be a big deal. You know, it's the ooh part of the meal where everybody stops and oohs and ahs and congratulates the hostess. And so it's a centerpiece of the meal, a showpiece of the meal, a symbol of bounty, and this is how wealthy we are, which is why it's used in a satirical way in the Dickens novel. But yeah, it would have been one of the final things served at the meal. So kind of the pièce de résistance, if you will, the thing that everybody gets to applaud at the end.
Right.
Right. So that's why the figgy pudding is in the song, because everybody wants to talk about the, it's like, you know, nobody wants to come to Thanksgiving dinner and talk about anything but the pumpkin pie. That's what it's really all about, is dessert. That's another way you can look at it.
Isn't it always, though?
That's right. Life is uncertain. Eat dessert first. If we can't do anything else, we're going to have figgy pudding, and we're not going until we get some.
That's right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Christy. I've been listening to you since we got you up on the computer, and Leah and I have definitely learned a lot tonight. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you.
You have a good night now.
You too. Thanks for calling.
Yep. Bye.
That's what I love about my audience. It's not just readings. It's anything that they can learn from, they can explore with, they got a question.
Yep, so, that was a good question, too. And that's a really, really good example of a Christmas tradition that people don't know what the heck it's about. Mm-hmm. You know, we sing this song, we hear the lyrics, but we don't know what anything, we don't know what a figgy pudding is. Why do we want one? Would I like it if I had it?
You mentioned Pfeffernuss as well. We're almost at break, but let's quickly find out what the heck is Pfeffernuss.
Pfeffernuss is a peppery, spicy cookie, and it goes to Germany, and it specifically is associated with one of St. Nicholas's helpers, Black Peter. And there's this long history to Black Peter I'm not going to go into right now, but they show up on December the 6th, which is St. Nicholas's Day, and that's when Santa or St. Nicholas shows up in the Germanic countries. And he has all of these helpers, and Santa's a much more strict kind of guy there. And if you're not good, Black Peter's going to stuff you in a sack and take you away. Or you can, that's where we get the coals and switches from, is like, if you're not on Santa's good list, you get bad things. Bad things happen to you. Well, the Pfeffernuss are a spicy cookie that is theoretically thrown down the chimney on St. Nicholas's Eve, December 5th, to announce the coming of Santa and Black Peter and all his other helpers.
Got it. And, of course, in those days, there weren't lawyers, there weren't child protection laws, reality shows about being victims. Yes, I was.
Well, and part of Black Peter's history is that he goes back to when the Netherlands was under Spanish rule, and he was either a Moor from Spain or a black slave, and he was doing Santa's bidding, and if he had to get a naughty child and stuff him in a sack, he was going to send that naughty child to Spain. That was the punishment.
That's big. All right,
that's big.
We're coming up close on break. This is Corby Mitlide on Empower Readings tonight. We have the fabulous Chef Christy, and we're discussing spirituality and traditions in holiday food and customs. So don't forget that we are taking your calls, 248-809-3475. That's 248-809-3475. You can call with reading questions for me. If you have food questions for Christy, that's wonderful. If you've got a family
trivia.
Yes, you have family tradition you want to share with us, bring it on. This is one of the more fun shows that I do. So there's fun and a little eggnog for everybody. So again, we're going to go to break in just a minute. We want you to call 248-809-3475. That's 248-809-3475. And join us in food questions and commentary with Chef Christy.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on, and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See, that's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
My sport is football, but my passion is education. My name is Nnamdi Asamoah, and this is how I live United. I see too many kids miss out on moving up. Kids who could go on to college, but just need that extra little push. So every year, I take promising high school students on a college tour. We check out the dorms, the library, meet some professors, find out where the best late night grub stops are. It shows them that there's a whole world beyond their own. But what's even better is that most of these kids decide college is for them. I'm Nnamdi Asamoah. I show kids that a higher education means a brighter future. So when it comes to living United, I don't just wear the shirt. I live it. Join me.
It takes all of us working together to make a difference. Find out how you can live United for Education. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find which classes he really needed.
You missed the lesson on telling dragons from dragonflies.
Right. I want to go to college, so I'm taking Algebra 2, Biology, and a foreign language.
Foreign language? You mean so you can talk to unicorns?
Well, not exactly. Unless they're French.
But Larry had no time for unicorns, or even for Miss Petunia Tutti's time-traveling tutorial, which met every other yesterday at 25 o'clock.
Sorry I'm late. My snarkball game went into overtime.
And he knew knowhowtogo.org was way better than hoping for a snarkball scholarship. So, while his friends all aced invisibility, when Larry finally got to college, they were nowhere to be seen.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Empower Readings with Corby Mitlide. Your calls are next at 248-809-3475. 248-809-3475. Empower Readings on Empower Radio. EmpowerRadio.com.
And tonight it's Fun with Chef Christy. We are doing a show on spirituality and traditions all around holiday food. And your calls, as always, are welcome for readings, 248-809-3475. But if you've got food questions, if you want to share your family recipes, family traditions, that's what we would also love to hear. So let's talk a little bit about family traditions. I know that with us, there was one thing that my mother served. Oh my God, this is so 60s. It's called mushroom rolls, and there is not one redeeming thing about it. We would take an entire long loaf of balloon bread, that's the white bread that has no nutritional value, cut off the crust, save them for bread pudding. Then we would use a rolling pin to roll out the bread very thin, and then we would put in glop, and the glop was a mixture of chopped up mushrooms, butter, flour, chives, a little salt, so it was all down to a goo. Then you would roll it up, and then you would brush it with more butter and bake it. It was a heart attack in tiny little cigar-shaped cylinders. But if it wasn't there, my Uncle Arnold would look at my mother with such reproach. Now, that's the kind of thing that, for me, is always tradition. You're not supposed to think about it.
Do you continue to make those at Christmas time? Do you make those same mushroom rolls, or it wouldn't be right?
No, because Carl and I really don't do anything for any of the holidays anymore. Because it's just us. We basically have no family around here. And I'm one of those people that thinks if you're just celebrating for two people, it's kind of sad. So that all passed away with my mother, but it's one of the happiest memories that I've got. We have another.
Well, I can't say that it's probably a bad thing that the tradition of the mushroom rolls with the balloon bread passed away, but I do think that it's too bad that you feel like you can't celebrate a holiday with just two people. I get asked that question a lot. How do you, I don't have any children of my own, and I get asked that question, how do you enjoy holidays without children to experience them through? And I am always kind of perplexed by that because I enjoy holidays for their own merit, for what they mean to me and what they continue to evolve meaning. You know, I find spirituality and tradition and meaning in them, a lot of them, for the reasons that I have found that resonate for me. I don't feel the need to have to introduce a kid to that every time. Yes, it's wonderful to see the wonder in children's eyes and to open them up to new traditions, but that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy it for its own merit on my own. So I would put in a plug for you guys, you know, having a glass of wine and toasting a nice Christmas Eve next to the fire rather than saying, oh, it's silly for us not. It's just the two of us. We shouldn't celebrate. Celebrate on your own terms, but celebrate, for goodness sake.
Well, we'll talk. I mean, we do the two things that we make a big deal of in our family is our anniversary and Valentine's Day because, you know, that's for us. We have another call for you, another Toledo. Leah has a question for Chef Christy. Leah, okay. Are you with us?
Sam, Miss Christy, what's the most unusual holiday tradition you've heard of?
Oh, my. You're going to have to narrow it down. Are we still talking about food, holiday food traditions here?
Yes.
Let's see. Well, I was just reading a tradition about Czechoslovakian Eastern Bloc countries that grew up with carp for Christmas dinner. And part of the tradition was going and getting the carp live two or three days before Christmas and then bringing it home and letting it swim around in the bathtub for a few days. And the kids would kind of make friends with it. And when they went to take a shower, they'd have to put the carp in a wash basin and hope it didn't flop out onto the floor before they could get it back into the tub. And then the dad would go in with a mallet on Christmas Eve morning and smack the fish on the head and kill it so they could eat it for dinner that night. That's probably the strangest one I've read today.
That actually, I can vouch for that, because if you go read, believe it or not, biographies of Manfred von Richthofen and the Red Baron, he talks about the Christmas carp, and his people were from East Prussia. They were in Silesia. So It looks like, you know, carp is not just the Eastern Bloc countries.
Well, and that kind of brings me back to one of the things that I wanted to talk about in food traditions is the idea of fasting before a feast. And a lot of people don't realize, a lot of people have heard of Lent, which is obviously goes from Mardi Gras through Easter in the springtime. And then the object of that was to fast for on whatever particular set of fasting you were going to do with Easter dinner as your big feast. What a lot of people don't realize is that Advent is the 30 days prior to Christmas, and it's the other big fast for in the year. And what used to be an Advent calendar was a countdown to the day when you got the goodies. I have actually seen Advent calendars now that have treats in them, and that just strikes me as, again, modeling history and getting your traditions kind of mixed up. Because the object of the Advent calendar is to count down to the feast, not to have a treat every day. And a lot of traditions have that. We were talking about Eid and and Lent going to Easter and things like that. There are several traditions that have that fasting before the holiday. And I think that a lot of things like the Christmas carp, that's the last fish meal before the big meal on Christmas Day. And that's why this Christmas carp tradition, and the funny thing about having it swimming around in your bathtub being a little bit more of a modern life thing, but that's why that's such a tradition, is because it's the end of Lent, or the end of Advent rather. It's the last fish dinner that you have prior to the feast on Christmas Day. So that shows up in a lot of different cultures, not just Christianity and Christmas, but in a lot of cultures they have this kind of fast leading up to a feast.
Well, the change in holiday tradition explains where all the excess holiday weight comes from.
Yes, I'm afraid that in the United States, excess holiday weight goes along with it. If we were fasting throughout the entire season of Advent and only feasting between Christmas and Twelfth Night, we'd probably not put on all that extra weight.
Well, I
Thanks
can tell
for
you,
calling.
You're a very unhappy pregnant woman that way.
Well, that's the, yeah, you have to make sure you take care of yourself there. All right, well, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Now, she brings up a brilliant point. So you've got a vegan, a vegetarian, someone allergic to blue cheese, gluten, and then there's the paleo dude who only eats meat and veg.
Right. Yeah, and when you're trying to keep your family traditions alive, and we think of, I mean, Thanksgiving is coming up, and that's a perfect example of a meal where we have a lot of traditional foods. And we have the story from the, you know, we all got fed the same story in elementary school, which we now know is not as neat and tied up in a tidy little bow as we were told, but we have turkey and we have corn and we have cranberries and we have maple and pumpkin and these traditional foods that tend to be all the New World foods that were introduced at the time, and they have to be on the table. We gotta have it. I have heard more people say it isn't Thanksgiving unless there is a turkey and a pecan pie or a pumpkin pie or something like that. And it can change from region to region, but you'll find that it's probably the most amalgamated meal in the United States that doesn't change that much from region to region because we're all basing it on this historical or pseudo-historical event.
Except for stuffing. I have
but
seen
yeah, stuffing. Stuffing is a good example of something that changes from region to region. Absolutely. Because you come down here in the South and you get cornbread stuffing. I went down when I married my husband. I spent my first Thanksgiving with he and his mother down in Florida and watched giblet gravy be made for the first time. And she had chunked up hard-boiled eggs in it. And that's, I've never seen that before. And then you get oyster stuffing in the Northeast, and you get walnut stuffing in the Midwest, and you get, you know, chestnut stuffing and loads of different types of what we'll call dressing because we really shouldn't be stuffing it into the bird and cooking it. But that is one area for artistic interpretation.
Yes.
In the dressing.
Yes, or argument, depending.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, it can get downright fisticuffs over the kind of dressing you got.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there have been more daughter-in-law, mother-in-law feuds, let me tell you.
Yeah, no doubt. But it can be a big challenge when you're trying to change your diet. I mean, I've gone gluten-free, I've gone dairy-free, I've eliminated a whole lot of things out of my diet that I know are no longer good for me, which are all found in the traditional Thanksgiving foods. And so you kind of have to take a step back and see, why are these foods important to us? What is our resonance with the spirituality of this food? Why do I need to have this on the table? Is it because my mother always made these mushroom rolls and it's just not Thanksgiving if it's not something that she made? Or is it a dish that a dearly departed ancestor always wanted to have on the table? And if we don't have great-grandma's green bean recipe, we feel like we are not honoring our ancestors, and we don't have a piece of them at the table. We mentioned Passover and Lent and Easter and all of those spring holidays, and leaving a place for Elijah at the table because he would be the one to make sure that the family was keeping the covenant. That's a, you know, there's a palpable presence in that, and you want to make sure that there is that presence is there. A lot of families will leave a table place setting set for a dearly departed loved one, especially if that person is recently departed. There will be an empty place setting for that person. And I have seen that in a number of different homes and a number of different holidays. And it's always very touching. You know, and some people will go to the extreme of actually putting food on the plate and wine in the glass and things like that, or some people will just have the place set for them. But that's a bit of keeping touch with your traditions, keeping touch with your spirituality, keeping your ancestors' traditions alive, and whether it's the food items that they had or acknowledging their presence or having a candle lit next to their picture. Those are all food traditions that involve our spirituality as well. In fact, backing up in the holiday cycle a little bit, back to November 2nd, All Souls Day, which is also known as Day of the Dead or Día de los Muertos, there are an awful lot of food traditions in Hispanic communities and Spanish communities that where they actually go to the cemeteries, they clean the graves, they put up fresh pictures, they bring fresh flowers, they'll set out a picnic, they'll have a party, they have a meal right there with the dead. Talk about bringing your spirituality and your food items all together. And there's a food that they make called alegría, which is popped amaranth and honey. It means joy. And that's a traditional food that's there specifically to feed the spirits of the dead ones. And it's a food that has to be had. In Italy, they have fava de morte, or beans of the dead, which are little almond cakes that are specifically supposed to be fed to the dead. And then there's the soul cakes. Everybody, we talked about a song lyric earlier. Everybody's heard the soul cake. Please, good mistress, a soul cake. Those are little cakes that are given on that day, on the day of the All Souls Day, and specifically to be fed to the dead, to be a commemoration of the dead, or to be eaten to absolve the sins of the dead. So those are some very spiritually connected foods that are tied into a very specific holiday for ancestor worship.
And now let me ask you this. Is Kwanzaa at all ancestor worship?
Kwanzaa's a great holiday. I love Kwanzaa. I hear criticism of Kwanzaa, well, it's a made-up holiday. Well, dude, I'm here to tell you, they're all made-up holidays. Some are just newer than others, and I think Kwanzaa's such a great holiday. I love the principles that it pulls in and the community that it really emphasizes. And really, at its heart, Kwanzaa is a harvest festival, which takes us full circle back to what I was talking about at the top of the hour about a lot of these being tied to agricultural-based economy and harvest festivals. And if you look at the foods that are associated with Kwanzaa menus, a lot of it looks like soul food. Collards, fried chicken, gumbo, okra and tomatoes, you know, a lot of these kind of foods that came up through the African-American community. But at its heart, one of the things that's always emphasized is the yam, because the yam is the king of vegetables in the African harvest festivals. And so you have this food that is being revered as the staple food that it is there, and it's brought into a real highlighted position in this meal because that's the big point of the harvest festivals in Africa. Now, Kwanzaa tries really hard not to get lumped in with Christmas, and it's really difficult since it starts on December 26th. And it turns into, people want to make it a gift-giving occasion. But the people that I know that celebrate it really try to stick with the emphasis of community and cooperation and being thankful and being specifically thankful for the harvest of food, of friends, of the year's events, you know, kind of tying harvest into a much larger picture. But it was started in 1966. It's been going for 40 years now. I think it's growing in popularity. I think it's a great tradition. I think it's a well-thought-out new tradition. And that goes back to what I was saying about know your history or recreate it incorrectly. This is one that people have, you know, looked at and said, let's come up with a holiday that our people who have been transplanted here can identify with. And they did kind of pick and choose, but at its heart, it pulls together a lot of old traditions made relevant. And I think that's perfectly legitimate.
So
and
that's an example.
Anybody who wants to invite me to their Kwanzaa holiday celebration, I'd be glad to come, and I'll bring food.
Yeah, trust me. If Christy says she's going to bring food, you are so dumb if you ask her. So let's look at creating tradition. We got about 15 minutes. If you want to start a grounded, thought-through tradition for your family, how do you go about doing it?
Well, something that we kind of glossed over that I wanted to touch on a little bit was food traditions that were specifically religious in observances. Okay, a lot of foods, like let's take Hanukkah, for example. Hanukkah is based around the miracle of having the oil lamp light the lamp for 8 days. And I got to tell you, now that I've played with oil lamps in my camp, I realized that the miracle was not that the oil lasted, but that wick lasted. It's
yes.
The wick that's the key to the oil lamps. Anyway, so the foods that are associated with Hanukkah are fried. They are fried in oil. Right? And so you end up getting foods like donuts. And if you just say, yes, donuts are Hanukkah food, you really kind of have, that's kind of a stretch. Like, how did we end up with donuts being a Hanukkah food? Well, it's because they're fried in oil, and oil is the thing that caused the blessing, you know. So I think you have to look at the germ of the idea. What are we celebrating here? What are we trying to commemorate? And once you understand that, then you can make your own interpretation of what your observance of that is going to be. So if what you're trying to observe is, our family tradition is that everybody's far-flung across the nation, and on Christmas Eve, we all make a point of calling in so that we all connect to one another. Well, so if that's your big tradition, then maybe what you want to do is something that recreates those ties. Family ties, maybe something tied with a string, maybe knots of pretzel bread that you make into knots to show family ties. You know, once you've identified what it is that you're trying to create a tradition around, then you can make your own interpretations.
I just got the immediate idea of the old string and tin can, and so you've got spaghetti,
right?
But I'm not sure what we would do with the tin cans yet. So... See, but that's one of the other things that I want to remind people of. This is supposed to be fun. There is no you should. There is no this is the rule you can't break. The world is changing, guys. We saw this. I'm going to go back very briefly to politics. One of the things that all of the pundits are saying today is how the demographic of the United States have so profoundly shifted from 30, 40 years ago. We are far more multicultural.
Mm-hmm.
We are far more international. We are differently ideated. And so old traditions, some will have to go by the wayside because they just don't make sense anymore. And
mm-hmm.
rather than leave a vacuum, make your own. You know, taking a look at modern family, you've got gay members, you've got straight members, you've got Hispanic members, white members, black members, Asian members, First Nations. Try a tradition of a braided bread of four or five different colors. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you dye it with food dye. The old Passover Seder plate had haroset, which was sweet stuff that was supposed to be like the mortar that the Jews helped build the pyramids with, and horseradish for the bitterness. Well, take that idea and find sweeter things, things to look forward to. Now is the time to let go of the traditions that remind you of bitterness and old thinking. If you want to make new traditions for ushering in this new world, that will excite your artistic mind and palate. Christy, can you think of something that you would like to throw out there as a possible new tradition along that line in your fertile mind? I know this is a question that you didn't...
No, this is not a new tradition, but it is another culture altogether in the Chinese culture. The end of the year and going on into the Oriental New Year, the kitchen god is honored. And the way the kitchen god is honored is they take all of their old pots and pans and all of their old crockery and they break it. And they start the new year with brand new stuff. And they bring in new pots and pans and new, and in fact, I have told people about this when teaching knife skills class and talking specifically about those plastic cutting boards and kind of disposable kitchen stuff like that and saying, you know, these are okay as long as you consider them to be disposable. You could think about it in the way that the kitchen god is honored, and every new year, get rid of the old stuff and get new stuff. And I think that's a wonderful tradition to think about. You know, you're talking about the changing of the year. If you go back to the Romans, you've got the god Janus, who looks forward and backward at the change of the year. Back to Samhain, where it's the veil between the two halves of the year. We're definitely looking at that stepping forward, looking back, being thankful for what we have been through, and then looking forward to the new. And so I think that's a great tradition that can be used in so many ways, and it can be updated, and it can be made modern for the kids who are all electronically, you know, wired. But I think that's a great tradition that could be brought in more into holiday celebrations, is that assessing what's gone before, being thankful, atoning, as the Jews do with the major holidays, the High Holy Days, and then moving forward, making New Year's resolutions, and starting with new things. Have I mushed enough cultural references there together into one?
You've done brilliant.
But it just goes to show that all of these different cultures recognize the same thing, that this is a time of transition, of thresholds, of moving forward in your life, in your spirituality, in your relationships with other people. In Japan, it's a time where you go and you settle all your debts, and then you eat noodles, and then, you know, there's a very set way of addressing the end of one year and the beginning of the new year. So I think that those are very important and really easily brought into a modern, relevant tradition that your family can create for itself.
Okay, we are almost out of time. Christy, very, very quickly, where can people find you?
They can find me on my Facebook page. It's Chef Christy-ATL. They can also find me on my blog at my website is kingstaste.com, and the name of my blog is King's Codex. And right now, during the month of NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, I'm doing my own personal thing of putting a blog post up every day. So there's a lot of volume right now. So if you're interested, this is a good time to follow me, because you're going to get a whole lot of stuff right now.
Terrific. And if you guys want to find me, firethroughspirit.com, Fire Through Spirit, or Corby Mitlide on Facebook, and 877-321-CORBY if you absolutely need me. Remember that next week is the past life party, so start thinking about the past life questions that you've got. And thanks so much to Christy, to our engineer, Sergeant Steve. We love doing this. Get ready for a really rollicking bunch of end-of-the-year shows. So until then, have fun in your kitchen, make your traditions, and remember our saying, no matter what you find in that kitchen, cross the bridge from fear to fearlessness and fly. There's something special. See you next week.